You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore. And today it's my great pleasure to welcome back Peter Dunlap. Peter is a psychologist who has a clinical and political practice doing work with activists on their political identity. Peter has been with us before, and the last time we were together, you talked about your book that was about to come out, and it has come out. Today we're going to go into some depth about that book. It is called Awakening Our Faith in the Future, The Advent of Psychological Liberalism. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you.
Here we are, sitting on the cusp of a whole new way of looking at the world, potentially.
Yes, yes. Hard to know exactly what it's going to look like.
But we've got a lot of hope. Not just us in America, but around the world, we see a representative of some of our most cherished ideals and ways of being in Obama, President-elect Obama.
Yes, yes. I feel a great deal of hope and excitement as to what we may be on the verge of seeing happening. The opportunity right now is probably never been higher that I know of, at least in my lifetime.
So let's talk about your book, Awakening Our Faith in the Future. There's a lot of very interesting ideas in this book. First of all, how did you come to write this? Let's start there.
Sure. Well, I guess that's kind of at risk a long story. I was raised in a very politically liberal family in the Napa Valley in California. And my family, going back four generations, had been in the California state legislature. And I was kind of thinking of doing that myself. But then my life in my early 20s spun in a very different direction, and I found myself studying psychology and philosophy and studying religion a little bit, and taking a much more introverted path than my father's extroverted political path. And that really took control over my life in a very positive way, where I was in therapy and I was learning to be a therapist, but I was also learning about history and human consciousness and how we came to be the people that we are. And that really dominated the next 20, 25 years. And I always had a hankering to get back to my interest in liberalism, my interest in social transformation, and the role that politics plays in that transformation. And I found that it was very difficult to know how to connect the psychological experiences I had had of my own transformations, my own growth, back to the political world. And so this book has been my effort to really pull those two back together, both in terms of my own life story and forming myself as a psychologist working in political practice, but also creating a frame for all of us in which the values of political liberalism and the values of the transformative values of psychology can be brought together to change how we do politics and to change our culture.
And Peter, it's interesting that you talk about these two worlds as being separate at some level, because there's an assumption that if you're into psychology / religion, you can't be into politics because they negate one another somehow.
Well, I think there's a way that when you turn inward, when you turn to the unconscious and in some level choose or have forced upon you the need to reconcile a range of emotions that you didn't know that you had and were feeling, or a range of experiences from your own life, that there's a way that it's very natural to need to be protected from the world and to have an incubator-like space to do that. The dilemma, though, is if you then think that's all there is, and you then become content to live in a protected space, a protected middle class space, in which doing therapy and raising your family is somehow experienced as enough, because I don't think it's enough.
And then politics becomes something that they do somewhere else, and you just have to put up with the results of it.
Yes, or you put up with the results of it, and if you have the money to be in therapy, you probably have the money to think you're in a very protected middle class niche, where you really don't have to face what many other peoples in the world and in our own country and in our communities do face. We don't have to face the poverty or other deprivations that are rampant.
What sense does someone who is able to live in that niche make of what goes on around them? Because you can't not see what's going on around you in terms of what's going on in the streets, homeless people, for example, or what's going on in overseas with our foreign policy, for example.
Well, I think many people are very conscious of that, and they vote and they recycle, and they're cautious about their level of consumption. They're alert to these things, and that's a real important part of what it takes to be a people. And so I think there is awareness of it, but I'm not sure people have much faith as to how much they can be a part of the change and how they have something unique to offer to their communities that is really very much needed. And so there's a hesitancy around participation.
And then once the step is taken to participate, say, in some group, most commonly recently there's been anti-war groups.
Sure.
Someone who's been living in this protected space goes in because they feel such an overwhelming need to be part of this and to make a statement. And they get into a group and they discover that within that group there are all of these little factions and strangenesses and competitions and unconscious behavior.
Oh, my.
Not very welcoming.
Sure. Well, it just turns out that when we gather together with one another, things aren't easy. Get a bunch of us in the room, I think whether liberal or conservative, and what are we going to use? What guidelines are we going to use? What ethic are we going to use to get along and work together? And that just has not been worked out that effectively in any of the organizations that I know of. And there are many organizations that are out there doing really good work, but still have troubling dynamics on the inside.
And so the book highlights, surfaces, and addresses some of these dilemmas.
Particularly with organizations that are left-leaning. That's really where I'm doing my work, working with organizations that take a progressive liberal stand on social and political issues.
Peter, we're going to talk more about how you address this in the book, but let's first of all paint a picture for someone who's not an activist in an activist group. What are some of the things that you see in these groups?
Well, there's so many different things that happen, but let me start with the idea that those individuals who are already activists and who are working really hard to change their communities. They go to city council meetings, they do precinct walking, they get together and talk strategy for the upcoming election cycle, they try to find candidates. These people are very hardworking and they really sacrifice tremendously for the rest of us. Their progressivism and their liberal intent really gives them a type of political energy. They've really realized a level of a political identity. However, one of the things that happens is I think they tend to underestimate how far they've come. And so they have a little bit of an awkwardness doing outreach to really increase their membership in terms of how to get people to be interested in being political. And so at the meetings, there tends to be a way of talking that focuses on strategizing and not enough on community building. That focuses on planning and who's going to do what, because the goal is to get the meeting over with, to really have a plan in place, because these people are exhausted and they're doing all of this for free, typically volunteer work, and they have their jobs and their families, and this is just extra that they do. And so my own interest has been to work with these groups to really support them to make their gatherings be more enjoyable, to enable them when they come together to really create a community feeling amongst themselves that others would want to sign on and join and be a part of.
Mm-hmm. So as I recall in the 80s when we were doing political work, at that point the meeting was everything and everything had to be decided in a meeting. And so we would go through a day we're having three or four different meetings.
Oh my.
And we've moved away from that now to where the meeting is kind of a last minute thing. Everyone rushes in and does what they need to do just immediately at the meeting so that, as you say, they can go home and get on with the responsibilities.
Work. Right.
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 So we've gone sort of, the pendulum has swung in the other direction now. What you're trying to do here is find a way to, first of all, have people understand what the pressures are on them, and second of all, how to balance that out as well as become more individuated, more real, more...
Yes. One of the ways of talking about this is I'm very interested in supporting organizations to be what I call learning organizations. In order for an organization to be a learning organization, at least in how I'm working with this term, they have to have certain practices. And they have to have a practice of what I call community engagement, that you have to be out there doing the political work. You have to be giving to your community. You have to be attending to the politics and the social needs in your community. That's community engagement. Additionally, you need to be educational. You need to be educating yourself on and other people in your organization and turning your educational energies outward toward others so that we can all raise our consciousness together about what it takes to be a people living in a sustainable economy and in a sustainable culture. But you also have to have a third practice, and maybe a fourth, but the third practice is that I think you have to have some focus on healing. And that within organizations, if there is a healing intention, if people are intent upon taking care of one another, then something new starts to happen. And I think that really addresses the dilemma of the meetings in the 60s and the dilemma currently in the meetings. Because we want to create meetings that people draw value from, that are individuating and that are transformative themselves.
And then isn't healing a somewhat complicated word also, because you know in California we have the reputation of being touchy-feely and people feel very uncomfortable going into a group and being healed. First of all, the concept of needing to be healed is
it's wild, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's one thing if you broke your toe and you need to go get it set. That's a type of healing.
But very rational healing.
Yes, but I'm afraid I mean something quite different that's a little intimidating. I was having lunch with a psychologist friend of mine before, while I was writing the book, and I was telling her what I was writing about, and she said, oh, this is great, Peter, but you really can't use the word healing. And so I puzzled that over for a few months and just said, to heck with it, I'm afraid I have to use the word healing. And it is very complicated. What I understand is that each one of us is wounded. Each one of us is injured. And I think that each one of us is wounded politically. We're wounded around our ability to engage one another openly in a direct way that leads to a sense of civic pride. We're wounded emotionally in terms of knowing how to use our emotions to connect to one another, to give us energy, to find a direction on which to find a common action. And these wounds are crippling. And yet here we are in November of 2008 with a new administration coming who had just inspired all of us through a transformative candidacy, and now hopefully we'll find ways of transforming and giving energy to all of us in other ways. And so we are finding ways of succeeding despite these political wounds. And what I'm interested in is finding ways to talk openly about the different ways we progressives are injured, we liberals are injured. And it's not just people living below the poverty line. It's not just those traditional constituencies we're trying to care for that need our caring. We need to take care of one another as well.
The thing that Obama is promising to model for us is just that, really, how to avoid getting sucked up into the little battles. I mean, the thing that stood out for me was there was some booing going on in his audience, and he said, you don't have to boo, you just have to vote.
Yes.
And I thought that was such an elegant and right to the point way of putting it.
I just finished writing an article for Tikkun magazine that's coming out this month in the November Tikkun. And in that article, I talk about Obama's leadership capacities. And I attribute them to two specific capacities. One is I call his religiosity. And we can get into that maybe in a little bit. That's really important, though. Another one is what I call his emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. I think these two are woven together, but just sticking with the emotional intelligence for a moment, it appears to me that when I listen to him speak and when I read what he's written, that he has some capacity to avoid scapegoating and blame, and that this enables him to really transform the landscape of the conversation in a way that people are willing to follow him, such as his speech on race. That was a transformational speech. It took on a challenge, confronted all of us with the depths of racism, and at the same time, it really was more than racism. It was a way that he had of drawing attention to human suffering. And I think that's our current challenge. We need to turn together to face each other's and our own suffering, and to do so openly.
And yet, I think also in that in that article that you mentioned, the Tikkun article, which, by the way, is called Awakening Our Faith in the Future, Obama's Renewal of Our Liberal Identity, and I'm sure people can find that on the Tikkun website at some point.
I'm sure it'll be on their website at some point. I think at first it'll be on the newsstands in their magazine.
Around the scapegoating and blame, it's become sort of embedded in our way of doing business almost. And to move away from that is easy to talk about. It's much harder in a culture that tends to see things in sort of dualistic terms.
Well, if you see things in terms of conservatives or liberals, that sort of polarizing political landscape, you're in trouble. And I think the opportunity for liberals is to recognize that politics is actually developmental, that we develop politically. And this is one of the main themes in my book. That we go through different phases of political development, and that as we go through those phases, we can raise our political energy to a new level of political development. And whether Obama is embodying a new level of political development consciously or intuitively, or maybe even only superficially, I can't tell yet. Nonetheless, he clearly is coming from a place that is causing all of our energies to be activated. People are experiencing politics as something interesting and hopeful for the first time in possibly a generation.
As much as he was disparaged for being just a community organizer, he was a community organizer of a very large community, and I think a lot of what we are talking about here, what you find in small activist groups, he's been dealing with for a long time. And this is really the baptism of fire that he's been through, I think.
Well, certainly one baptism. There may be a few more ahead for him on the world stage.
But you feel like at least you know he can handle it.
I think he can handle it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm actually completely confident that he can handle it. Because, you know, he's not alone. The idea that somehow, you know, the whole world is on his shoulders just doesn't make sense to me. I mean, look at the men and women standing around him on the stage during his first press conference. Those are the people leading our country now, and those are the people we need.
Mm-hmm. And they all look so happy to be there.
Well, you know, I think that those are people who have achieved a level of political development that our country depends on, and they are living out their destiny. They are living out their calling. They have found a way to take their own suffering, to take their own sensitivities and talents, and to really forge a political identity that's responding to the needs of our time.
Well, then let's compare it with the McCain-Palin campaign that was not at the same level of development in a lot of ways.
It really isn't, in some very substantial ways. If you boil it down simply to their stand on issues and their attitude toward the size of government, that's a throwback to an earlier stage of political development that has its origins all the way back into the 1600s, and the way in which we were beginning to throw the yoke off of certain authoritarian structures in our society. And it was really important back then. It's still really important as part of our foundation. But human suffering is so pervasive that government has the opportunity to be responsive to human suffering in broader and deeper and fuller ways. And that's one of the biggest differences that I see between the current conservative voice and the voice of progressivism and liberalism that Obama represents.
We remind our listeners that we're talking with Peter Dunlap, who's been on our show before. If you go to www.raisingsandradio.org, it's under Dialogues to Change Our Political Future. We'll find them there. And the book is Awakening Our Faith in the Future, The Advent of Psychological Liberalism. I want to talk a little bit, Peter, about religion, and you had mentioned religiosity. There's a tendency amongst progressives or liberals to see religion as part of a problem that we need to move away from.
Well, this is one of perhaps the two biggest stumbling blocks for progressives and liberal organizations, and that is what I would call their attitude toward religion. I see it as something that's based in a political wound around what we liberals have successfully overcome, and that is the authoritarian side of religion, or the authoritarian side of any of our cultural institutions, not just religion. But there's a real inclination to throw the baby out with the bathwater because of the ways we haven't reflected deeply enough on the wound that gives rise to our sensitivity around the abuses of authoritarianism. So this wound really becomes a source of prejudice, as I see it, in progressive and liberal organizations and progressive and liberal activists and leaders, that there's a real woundedness around what religion actually is. And what makes it a prejudice is that I struggle to find ways of getting progressives and liberals to be able to openly talk about their suffering around religion, and turn to the possibility that that is not all there is to either religion or to the human being's experience of being religious.
Do you think if we understood religion a little more, we would understand what we call fundamentalist religion? The way it's out there, it's fundamental Islam or fundamental Christianity or fundamental Judaism or something.
Absolutely. And in fact, if we were to do that, we would start having to challenge our own secular fundamentalism, that we have our own brand of fundamentalism which dominates our subculture, our liberal subculture. It's one of the things that makes us the most offensive to the religious right and to other Christians and other people of religious belief when they just simply cannot stomach the way liberals and progressives arrogantly articulate their values. As much as I hold the egalitarian values very close to my heart and consider myself to be a liberal, I'm embarrassed by how we've turned a blind eye to people of faith. And I think it's just one of many ways we shoot ourselves in the foot politically as well.
Can you describe something that you've taken part in where you have these two polar opposites in the same room and you are trying to surface some of the issues around that?
I'd love to be able to say yes, but that's something I haven't done yet.
But this is where you're heading.
Well, it's certainly something that I think we have to do, mm-hmm. and I want to be a part of that. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going about it a little less directly than that. The work that I do in progressive and liberal organizations is that I really try to raise the issue when those people of faith aren't around, and which sometimes goes a little way, sometimes goes a long ways. Mm. And there are organizations that really have already taken this on in a very deep and committed way, such as the Tikkun organization around Michael Lerner's work and his book, The Left Hand of God. In that organization, they have a spiritual a network of spiritual progressives across the country of people with liberal progressive values, egalitarian values, who are also people of faith. And while this is not near the size of group that the religious right is yet, it certainly could be the beginning of a religious political left in this country that is part of the transformation that's ahead. And in some ways, I think Obama is a representative of this movement in ways that I don't know just how much yet. It's to watching him articulate his own religiosity is still new. I'm still listening for that.
So describe how he's articulating his own religiosity.
Well, there is a in the article for the Tikkun magazine, I cite a speech he gave in 2006, I think it was, about religion. And he really takes on the left and the right. In his Senate election, I think it was against Alan Keyes, Keyes accused him of, I think, basically of not being Christian. And Obama did not take offense. He became, in his typical way, curious and open, and just simply drew attention to how it was a little disconcerting for him to have someone accuse him of not being Christian when he experiences himself to be a Christian. And so that's part of it, that he has this experience of being a Christian. And in this speech, he talked about how that came about for him, how he was a community organizer in Chicago, and how he was working with all these different faith communities, and he had a firsthand experience of the tremendous value that these communities offered each member, the support, the love, the kindness, the holding. And in that, it sounded in his speech that he had to face some sort of crisis inside himself and work that through in order for him to then really join in and participate in that community. And I think that was part of his transformation that makes him the man that we're willing to follow.
And yet there's this other piece that was played up a lot with Reverend Wright incidents.
Yes.
Where he had to try and articulate what he was thinking about this, and no matter what he said, he was going to be in somebody's bad camp.
Well, and he was brilliant on this because he didn't try to throw Reverend Wright under a bus. He didn't back away and try to rise above it the way Kerry did with the Swift Boat attack. He went right for the moral argument at the heart of all of it. And he took on the issue of race, and he also really faced how he was part of this black congregation that was just of critical importance to him, but that community also had limitations. And so in that, he articulated all of it just beautifully.
Mm. So he embodies the idea of limitations being okay.
Yes.
Which is quite refreshing in a lot of ways, isn't it?
I think so.
The other thing that we saw with Obama, as you've described, a sense of being able to think and feel on his feet.
Yes.
And speak from that.
Yes. I think in that he's had to learn in a new way what emotions are and how to use them. Now, this may sound like just sort of a strange way of thinking, but what if we don't use emotions for what they're for? What if emotions are for roughly four things? That they're for being able to tell what's going on around you. You know, if you're feeling sad, it may have something to do with there being some loss that's happened around you. If you're feeling scared, it may be because something frightening is happening around you. If you're angry, it may be because you're being blocked or thwarted in some way. So what if the first thing emotions for is being able to tell what's going on around you? And the second thing, therefore, is providing you with some energy, you know, to be able to move in some direction. So they're motivating. The third thing, therefore, is therefore helping you pick a direction. If you're angry, you're going to move in one direction. If you're scared, you're going to move in a different direction. If you're embarrassed, you're going to move in a third direction. If you're excited and hopeful, that's a whole new direction as well, as we're seeing laid out in front of us right at this moment. This moment is filled with both fear and hope and excitement for our country and for us as a people. So there's the third purpose of emotion. The fourth purpose of emotion is to connect us to one another, to bind us together. Now, all of these purposes of emotion we've been working diligently on in all sorts of creative and new ways through the way psychology has come into our culture, through psychotherapy, through the media, and through many other means. In our families, with our friends, with ourselves, in our jobs, we're now even talking about having an emotional intelligence and what you do with that. But what if there's a corollary to that learning, and that's learning how to use emotions in public.
This is a taboo topic, isn't it? Emotions in public.
Exactly. Well, you know, some of us were a little dissatisfied with Obama's demeanor. We found it to be cool. He was accused of that regularly. Though, frankly, for an African-American man in this culture, I thought that he managed his own emotionality exquisitely. As much as I might have wanted a little more overt passion, I don't know that that would have played all that well. As much as many of us were calling for that, I have doubts that would have played well. And I don't know exactly if that's intrinsic to him. So I don't know that he could have mustered it. I think it's intrinsic to him to be this meditative, more emotionally digesting person mm-hmm. than emotionally expressive.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, McCain and many others on the right and left have been accused, rightly or wrongly, of really misusing their emotions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Biden had some reputation of being a little bit of a hothead or a little bit too spontaneous at times. And yet he managed one of the best moments in all of the debates when he just allowed himself to break down a little bit during mm-hmm. the debate. And yet it was pretty contained. You know, Hillary Clinton had a boost in the polls when she went from being a little bit cool to sharing some of her emotionality.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have a history of scapegoating people who display emotion in public. Ed Muskie, back in his presidential run, was absolutely scapegoated for crying at one point.
Mm.
Howard Dean was deeply scapegoated when he was trying to rouse his support after losing a primary, and it got out to the media and in sort of a crazy way that they played up and shot him down. And there's been, you know, many other cases. You know, Dukakis and Kerry, I think, are examples of going too far the other way, too far toward the rational.
Amazing that this emotion is part of our very humanity, and amazing that it has become such a wedge issue in a way.
Interesting. Say a little bit more about how you say it's become a wedge issue.
Well, as you say, I mean, had Obama been a little more emotional, he could have been accused of being the emotional black man, I think is what we're saying
right.
But he was too cool, so, you know, what's wrong with this guy, right? Howard Dean went off and did this big yell, and he's just never going to live that down.
He's not, is
no.
he?
No. But, you know, part of being an emotional person is being real with the emotions that you have.
Yes.
And being real, really, is the thing that's getting in trouble here, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Well, in my research that's at the basis of my book, I interviewed these progressive political leaders in a group setting, and as I was just asking them very normal psychological-oriented questions of drawing them in and having them be open with one another, they started expressing feeling, and they had such a delightful experience that the emotion was in the room with one another, and that they had worked through this taboo, and it was just like this sort of revelation for all of them. One woman was said in the group meeting, she said, "Oh my goodness, all of you elected officials are being emotional here with me. This is so cool and exciting. I mean, you're showing your emotions." And we all had the hugest laugh out of that.
Yeah.
And the type of group cohesiveness in the research group that came together as a result of that was tremendous. And it really allowed us to deepen the conversation emotionally and to become more intimate
mm-hmm.
with one another.
What I'm thinking here is that there's this sense that white liberals always want to help. You know, they want to go into a poorer community and help. They want to go into another country and help. The helping is actually coming from a place of real emotion, but instead of expressing the emotion and saying, it just tears me up to see that you're in such and such a situation, they have to put it under this heading of, we're going to help you whether you want it or not.
That's a stage of political development. It's a very, in my model of political development, it's a relatively high stage of political development. That has its origins in the early 1800s, where we really started seeing the travesty that the modern world was creating, the impoverishment, the devastation, the harm that was being done to women, to children, to minorities, to the working class, And so people rose up and started creating a new ethic. The egalitarian values started emerging at that time in a whole new way that led to the progressive movement, that's led to numerous liberal movements. Now, people who identify with the goal is social progress, that's very important. They are 90% of our activists out there. However, they do tend to focus outside of themselves on helping others. Now, is there something wrong with that? Heavens no. Is that all there is? No.
Well, the problem that there actually is a problem with that, because the person or the people or the community that they're trying to help understand that on a gut level, that there is something that is being handed out, perhaps, rather than lived. And I think it's a very different place, isn't it? The handing out is kind of a place of being pulled back, not engaged.
I agree completely. There's an overly rational, externally focused, projecting one's own loneliness or suffering or despair or anger that goes into liberal political activism. That's part of what limits our effectiveness and part of what limits rising to a higher level of political development. On the other hand, going too far inward and getting stuck in thinking that the answer is psychotherapy or meditation or some withdrawal from the world is equally problematic, if not more problematic. And it's bringing those two back together, bringing the introverted path of spiritualism or psychology and psychotherapy back together with political values, liberal political values, that creates what I call the psychological citizen. The citizen who goes about their work in a more lived way, open about their own suffering, able to contact it and talk willingly about it in the midst of their activism, have it be part of their activism. Mm-hmm.
So this is a stage of development, you're saying, a stage of political development.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about some of the other stages.
Sure, absolutely. In my developmental model, and in the book there are charts about this, and it's pretty soundly research-based, but it's also still pretty new. The idea that there is political development is originally, as best that I know, in the vein that I'm using it, developed by the British Jungian Andrew Samuels in his 1993 book called The Political Psyche, and then further developed in another book of his, wonderful little book of his called Politics on the Couch that came out in 2001. Those are great, great reads in this area. But Andrew's responsible, in my view, for the idea of political development. The idea that individuals develop politically. Now you can line that up with individuals develop morally, individuals develop cognitively, individuals develop socially, develop emotionally, develop psychosocially, develop psychosexually, with every known theory of human development that was developed emerged in the 20th century from different theorists. Another way we develop is we develop politically. Now, what I bring uniquely to that is that I've identified stages of development, and that the stages of development go back to the beginning of Western culture. They're probably cross-cultural, but I have not done the research to really make that claim. But my research is in Western culture, and that just for the purpose of this interview, there's a lot more depth in the book about this, but just for the moment, let's talk about it in terms of pre-modern and modern, and that transformation takes place at roughly in the 1600s. In pre-modern political development, I identify as a stage of what I call religious liberalism. Now, how far back you trace this, it could easily be traced back a couple thousand years in terms of the way that religion as an institutional form came into the West and helped coordinate human freedom. Now, for all of our liberal critique of religion, and for the fact that there's truth in our critique, though not as much as we tend to think, for all of the damage religious institutions have done, it's a little hard to suggest that the idea that religion and liberalism fit together in any way, but they absolutely do. I think the research just shows this to be true, that religious institutions historically have brought about profound levels of human freedom. Now, like any institutional form, they get encrusted, they get hardened, and we need to renew them. Sometimes we need to renew them on such a large scale that something is really transformed. So in the early 1600s, a transformation was taking place in Western culture, and it went throughout that century. An example of that is the way in which in the mid-1600s, John Locke said, you gotta let the sovereign decide what your religion is, because we can't have people deciding their own religion. That's too dangerous. It'll fracture us in too many different violent ways. Then a bunch of Quakers, over 400 Quakers, died because they would not give their religion up. That was a transformative moment in Western culture. John Locke wrote about it and he said, oh my goodness, I was wrong. We actually have to let people decide their own path of religion. And this was an awakening of religious freedom. And that led to an awakening of political freedom and the advent of political liberalism, what's known as laissez-faire liberalism. And that enabled us to break free of landowners and individuals to be able to move to the city-states and to be able to have their own income and have their own jobs and determine their own future. This was the beginning of political freedom. However, it was crippling in so many different ways, and so that's a stage of liberalism. That's political development, political liberalism of the libertarian sort. But then it became clear that political freedom just led to so many other ways that people became indentured slaves to the new employers, to the new industries in the cities. And that had to be challenged in the early 1800s by, like, there was this woman in France whose name I'm not going to remember, Flora. Well, I don't remember her name, but she was both a feminist and a socialist. And she wrote and argued for workers' rights. And that was way before Marx. And there were other revolutions that were transpiring just prior to that, the French and the American Revolution. And through these means, we had to create a whole new level of liberalism beyond the first level of political liberalism, that's libertarian, which is breaking it free from authority, to a new idea of an egalitarian frame of values, where we use government, that government's not something we break or free from, but we use government to create well-being for all people. And that's a movement from political liberalism of a libertarian sort to political liberalism of the egalitarian sort. From there, bear with me, I'll try to make this a little shorter. From there, we move into the mid-1800s, when people started looking inward, either on spiritual paths or on what began in William James's life as a psychological path. The idea that we have unique human consciousnesses that are something for us to develop. And that's where we pulled away from our social roles, and we started, many people started identifying with their unique destiny, an idea of their destiny, and they started pursuing that. That got almost usurped by the beginning of psychoanalysis and psychology in the late 1800s and early 1900s, where an institutional form grew up, what I call psychological liberalism, around Freud's work, where he began to institutionalize this internal path. For all the flaws of Freud's work, he really recognized that we were not such rational creatures that political liberalism had defined us as, but that we are deeply passionate creatures, and it's that passion that is the root of our being. We had broken away from emotion because of how emotion had connected us to the past. Political liberalism focused us on being rational. Psychological liberalism said, hey, you're going too far. You've got to return to the value of your emotional life, to the value of your passionate life. And that's what I call a private life psychological liberalism, where people turned inward and started recognizing the value of emotion, of connecting back to one another, of seeing how the past influences the present, and doing the type of history work psychologically with ourselves to heal our being. But that hasn't gone far enough, which is why I postulate the next stage of liberalism, which I also call psychological liberalism, but not of a private sort, of a public sort. So it's a public psychologicalness, and that this is the stage of political liberalism that I'm trying to live into myself through my work, and that I'm inviting others to live into with me, because it will transform political culture. It will give us a context in which political liberalism and psychological liberalism can come together to create community engagement, education, and healing, and maybe new religious practices as well. There's too many paragraphs on my model of political development. It's a stage model. I use it in organizations I work with to identify what stage they're at and what practices they're going to need to use if they're to raise their political energy to a higher level of political development. And I also use it in the work I do with individuals.
So that's the place that I want to go to now, is at the individual level, because you can have an organization that has a movement in the direction that you're suggesting, but within that organization there are individuals that are also at different stages of development.
Yes. Typically, though, within an organization, there's not too wide a range of developmental levels if the organization has achieved some level of being professionalized. If there are people that are paid staff, they're coming in to do a job, such as put out a magazine, or elect a candidate, or provide a program to a community. There's enough cohesiveness that it doesn't invite too wide a range of political development. The wider a range of political development within an organization, the more tension there'll be, the more dysfunction there'll be.
Okay.
Whereas within volunteer organizations, it's a whole other matter, and the spectrum of political development is much wider, and it's one of the troubling things that troubles those organizations and makes them have a difficult time being effective.
Ah, that's interesting. So what? Let me see if I can repeat what you're saying. Within an organization that's organized, say, to do community work, you'll have similar kinds of ways of thinking and being. Mm-hmm. But in a volunteer organization that's come together to do getting out the vote or something like that, you're going to have potentially differences that are can be more fractious.
Yes, yes. In the groups I've worked with, when a volunteer, I've worked with some really interesting creative groups that are trying to come together and build a new way of doing politics that combines the internal with the external, combines community activism with some sort of healing work, attention to the self. Mm-hmm. These groups typically start with an enthusiasm and an excitement for what's possible, and then they tend to peter out a little bit. Now, I think one of the reasons they peter out is they underestimate what it's going to take to work with the differences of the people they're gathering together, and they don't give a lot of forethought to who they're inviting to join them or to have clear practices that would support working with people at different developmental mm-hmm. levels.
And then when you throw culture into that mix too, different cultures or different cultural ways of being, things get a lot more tricky.
I think so. I think they must. The cultural diversity work that I think we have to learn to do would be really supported if there was some sense of knowing what to do with developmental difference, so that you really could work openly with the cultural difference.
Mm-hmm. Because at some level, even psychology is controversial in certain
Absolutely.
Communities.
And in some ways for good reason. As much as it's a science, and it's a science I trust, and it's a discipline that I trust, we have our blindnesses in psychology. And some of them are around culture. Though in the last 40 years, the amount of work that's done in that area is substantial. So there really is knowledge out there that can help us deal with the cultural differences.
And Peter, what we're looking at today is really a crisis that, let's talk about the climate change crisis or the environmental crisis. This is something that is very pressing, but it also helps organize our thoughts, doesn't it? We really have are getting to the point where our backs are against the wall.
Well, I hope so, but we also are pretty short-sighted. The economic crisis and the fact that gasoline's now well under $3 a gallon will really risk putting the issues of environmental sustainability on the back burner again. So I'm a little nervous about that.
Huh. And do you think, though, that people can ignore the whole climate discussion that's going on? I mean, certainly the Bush administration managed to do that very well. But I think they're partly responsible for heightening the awareness in people.
Well, it's interesting how Bush has successfully helped us consolidate and focus our attention on what we need to do. It's amazing what you might be willing to do when you're really frightened. Bush's willingness to turn his back on science is so disturbing to me, and it's so essential that we turn and draw from science. And so I hope that we have the global energy conversation. I hope it really is brewing and will take off, and I think it has to.
It has to, it seems, yeah. Storytelling has become
pretty popular,
and it's really gets at the heart of listening with your heart and your head,
yes,
doesn't it?
It really does. We all have stories, and for those of you that have been in psychotherapy, you've learned how to tell your story that primarily focuses on your private life. In the work that I do with organizations, one of the very first practices I use comes from Andrew Samuel's book, Politics on the Couch, in which he talks about taking a political history and doing that in groups. And I've adopted this practice, and it works wonderfully. I in fact, just did this in a human development class with 21 to 23-year-olds at Sonoma State University on election day. I did this. And it was a lot of fun. And so I started by interviewing the teacher of that class and taking her political history, which basically means asking questions like, what was your first experience of being political in your family? When did you first become aware that there was a larger world outside your family that was governed by power dynamics or political dynamics? And as people start reflecting on these questions, they start looking back at their own histories and their quote-unquote private life histories, and they start connecting their histories to the world. And then when they get back together and tell each other the stories of the connections they're making, people start connecting more to one another, mm-hmm. and really holding a common history, a common political history that is energizing, that gives them a sense of shared past and common interests and, of necessity, a shared future.
And so the students that you were with on election day, mm-hmm. how were they able to make sense of that?
Well, in different ways, depending on their own prior experience with learning how to tell a story. Some had a great deal of difficulty with it and didn't quite know how to even answer the questions, but they stuck with it and did the best they could.
Mm-hmm.
When we came back together and some people were telling their stories, there were stories of not being political at all and just being shocked when they came out and found that the world was the way it is. There were people who told of stories of suffering from prejudice in their communities, and in sharing their story there were tears involved in that. There were stories of common shared events. The 9/11 is certainly a shared event for this generation that happened pretty early in their lives. Mm-hmm. That was, in some ways, an unreflected defining moment in their life.
In the work that I've done around the war, it's very frustrating to recognize that a large proportion of people don't actually understand how wars come about and what happens in war. And then when they do, when it's really becomes unavoidable, there's the sense of being so upset that and shocked at our culpability in it that they tend to just pull away. And I think this is where you're talking about the healing coming in, to accept that we all have some responsibility in, for example, the war on terror and the invasion of Iraq, and to be able to hold that in a way that makes us more willing to risk going out into the neighborhoods and the communities and being with that pain and responsibility.
Yes. In addition, what about taking responsibility for events that happened that our fathers, grandfathers, great-grandmothers were involved in? You know, my great-great-grandfather came from Missouri and at 17 with his mom went up to Oregon and then came down to California. Is there any chance that he killed a Native American on the way? There are no stories in my family that say he did or didn't.
Mm-hmm.
He was a 17-year-old boy man. His father was dead. What was his life like?
Mm-hmm. You know,
he later settled in the Napa Valley and became a political leader in that valley.
Mm-hmm.
He founded the town of Napa.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Nathan Coombs. But what stories have come down in the family? One is that his son, Frank Coombs, was a deeply prejudiced man. He was a racist. And so my great-grandfather, Frank Coombs, who at one point was the ambassador to Japan, was also strongly against giving the Chinese the right to vote. And I just assumed that he enacted that in his community in a prejudiced, racist way.
Mm.
How much responsibility do I have for what Frank Coombs did in the Napa Valley?
Mm. And at the same time, we can't, again, scapegoat anybody for this. I mean, I look at the differences in how the troops coming back from Vietnam were treated.
Yes.
To how they're treated now. And at that point, I wasn't here at that time, but it seems as though all of the fear of what we were doing was projected onto those people who actually were drafted.
Exactly.
And now we have the support the troops. Of course, it means a lot of different things, but we need to find a way to also embrace those young people coming back and understand that what they've done because we asked them to, we allowed them to do it.
And I think this is where each of us has to find what contribution we're meant to give to changing the circumstances, to ending scapegoating. And the work you're doing in having people tell stories of wars that they've personally experienced so the rest of us can listen to those stories. I've never experienced anything remotely like someone in my family dying in a war.
Mm.
And we had a 4th of July party in my neighborhood, and one of my neighbors read a letter from his uncle who died in World War II, and one of his last letters.
Mm.
And so I think the work that you're doing is a way that you're finding your destiny, your unique contribution to make. And that's what I think each of us can do. But it's something that we do by helping each other find their way, by coming together in new and creative ways that activates each of our unique destinies as human beings who are developing politically.
Mm-hmm. Peter Dunlap, I want to thank you for being with us. Again, your book is Awakening Our Faith in the Future, The Advent of Psychological Liberalism. Is there a way for people to get in touch with you?
Yes. I have a website that'll be up hopefully within the next couple of weeks. That website is centerforpoliticaldevelopment.com. It's an organization that I'm starting called the Center for Political Development. And my email address that anybody can reach me at is centerpd@gmail.com.
Peter, we'll be having many more of these conversations.
Oh,
I think this is a direction that we're all ready to begin to grapple with.
Yes.
So
yes.
I thank you for all of the work that you've been doing, the book, and the future.
Well, thank you so much for having me here, Susan. This has been just a blast.
Of people going by, I see friends shaking hands, saying, "How do you do?" They're really saying, "I love you." I hear babies cry, I watch them. much more than I ever knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.